You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's hard to imagine now, but 7 years ago, YouTube didn't even exist. Today, it's the largest video site in the world and the second most popular search engine after its parent company, Google, which bought it in 2006 for over $1.5 billion. Its popularity among the younger demographic has led a whole new generation to grow up watching more YouTube than television. In his most recent article for The New Yorker called Streaming Dreams, YouTube Turns Pro, staff writer John Seabrook looked at what happens when a company like YouTube grows up. Where does it go next? And what does that move mean for the future of television? I'm pleased to welcome John Seabrook back to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
So give us some perspective. How many videos are viewed through YouTube each day?
Well, I think 3 billion is the number they're using now. It went up from 2 billion to 3 billion in the last year. 48 hours of video are uploaded every minute.
Now, who's doing the uploading? Because I don't know one person who uploads. I know a lot of people who have watched YouTube on and off. But are there people who have special reasons to upload?
Some are, but a lot of people are just taking videos on their phone. And if you ever sort of touch the little thing that says on the bottom of your phone, you can email, there's usually an option saying, go to YouTube. They made it so easy to just go right from your phone to YouTube that, you know, I mean, in a way, it's being used the way that it was originally intended, which is a storehouse for video. So if you don't want to have the video on your phone, you can put it there and leave it there, and then you know where it is.
And then hope that somebody actually will find it interesting enough to watch.
Well, people might, or you'll just have it for yourself. It can go either way.
But people also upload records, just records without any video. You get the album cover and nothing else, and yet they seem to feel the need to share their record collection.
And a lot of people upload records before they're actually out there and make the producers really angry. But, you know, that's a good point. I use YouTube more as a kind of on-demand radio than as a video because it has so much music on it. And it's just the easiest, fastest way to get to a particular song, whether it's a rare one or a popular one.
For all its popularity, doesn't it seem that people often feel that their time on YouTube is time wasted?
If you put in more than a half an hour, I get that feeling. I sort of that sagging, oh my gosh, where did that last half hour go? But, you know, it often is you spread it out 3 minutes here, 3 minutes there. It's sort of like a trip to the virtual water cooler, and it doesn't really feel like a chunk of time you've invested.
So people come back again and again during a day?
I think so. I mean, people tend to send links over email. Or, you know, you see one thing and then you see a link to it and you follow that. But I tend to use it more as a sort of a browsing thing than a sort of sit down and watching thing, which is a lot of what my article is about.
And had you done that before you decided to write this article?
Yeah. But my children use it much more as a sort of a television experience than I do. So it's a generational difference there.
And what's the most popular content today? Comedy, music videos, how-to videos?
Well, the most popular videos now have become, they used to be the sort of viral videos, the kind of random ones, but in the last few years, music videos have actually surpassed those, and so Lady Gaga and so forth are up there, you know, same way they are on the charts. But there's still, you know, the Charlie Bit My Finger being a famous one, you know, just cute little kids. There's a new one every day, a viral video that David Brooks is writing about one today in the New York Times. It's almost every day there's a new one.
How does it compare in audience to a video site like Hulu?
They have Hulu. The interesting difference there is that although YouTube has a lot more users, 6 times more, I believe, Hulu gets people to watch for longer because Hulu has longer form content that comes from television, whereas YouTube has sort of, you know, 3-minute videos.
And the TV producers prefer Hulu because they're controlling it.
That and because it sort of feels like it's a safe environment for advertisers. There's not sort of random things that you're afraid your ad is going to be associated with because it's not user generated content. It's all professionally produced content on Hulu.
And when I'm watching something like the Colbert Report, the same ads pop up again. That's provided by Hulu, but so they have standard ad buys. What happens on YouTube? How do they get advertising?
Well, the dream of advertising on YouTube is that it'll be audience-based rather than show-based so that they'll know who you are because you're getting it over the internet and there's an IP address, and they'll also know a certain number of things about you, what you've Googled, what you've bought, various other things. And so there'll be ads that are targeted explicitly for you. So you'll see a different ad when you're watching the same show than I see.
So since Google owns this, are they cross-referencing? And is Google's using the same approach to advertising that they use on Google?
They're hoping to. It's worked so well on Google, the sort of, you know, an ad running against a search term, and the advertisers buy that search term, and then you see the ad. On YouTube, it's harder because the search terms don't really match up as well with videos, and keywords don't work as well because sometimes the words are inside the videos, but when you search, you can really only search for the title, the metadata. So it's proven to be a tougher nut to crack to do that ad matching that they do so well on Google.
We know who started Google. We know who started Facebook, but I have no idea who created YouTube.
Well, it was three guys. They were all former employees of PenPal. They were 26 years old. And as the legend goes, two of them were at a dinner party in San Francisco, and guests took videos of each other, and they realized they had no place online to put them the way you could use Flickr for still photographs. So they thought, hey, let's have a kind of a site that will be like Flickr, but for video. And they launched it in May of 2005, and 6 months later, it had 5 million viewers, and it just grew from there. It was a couple of different things coming together at the same time. It was wide videos in phones. That was a big part of it. It was Flash, the player that let you play it really easily, as opposed to using Windows Media, which was complicated. It didn't work with certain formats. And it was broadband. It was the ability to stream, you know, fairly quickly a large amount of data. Those three things coming together really made it happen.
So actually the users determined how YouTube developed. They just wanted it to be a kind of a video version of Flickr.
Right. As always with Google, it's sort of all about the users, and they really sort of try to just sort of set up a playground that the users can figure out what they want to use it for and then push it that way.
So when did they realize that they needed to do things to expand beyond presenting home videos?
Well, there was always this kind of interesting schism, and in my article I write about it, between the sort of people who just wanted to watch other people's home videos and then the people that wanted to watch stuff they had missed on TV. One of the founders had the Janet Jackson Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction in his mind because, you know, that was a huge event. A lot of people talked about it, but if you didn't actually see it on television, it was hard to call it up again. So they wanted a place where, but of course that got into all kinds of copyright problems. And those two kind of sides of YouTube persist to this day.
We're talking with New Yorker staff writer John Seabrook about YouTube's transformation from a home video user-generated site to the largest and most popular online video bank in the world. He wrote an article called Streaming Dreams, YouTube Turns Pro. It's in the New Yorker. So let's talk about copyright. Were they aware from the start that that they were going to run into copyright problems?
Well, this is a question that is the subject of an enormous lawsuit that Viacom filed against Google, YouTube, and that is now under appeal. And in the course of prosecuting that suit, a lot of the emails that the founders wrote came out. And you can see from those emails, some of which I quote in my article, that they were certainly aware that there could be issues. But at the same time, they knew that copyrighted content drove so much traffic. And so they took a kind of a laissez-faire approach. If somebody asked them to take it down, they would take it down. But if they knew about it, but the content owners didn't ask, they didn't take it down.
Did they think that by only streaming the content that they were protected against copyright lawsuits? Because you can't download from...
That's right. So you don't actually own the file. But legally, I don't think there's a distinction between whether you sort of stream illegal content or whether you actually download illegal content. I certainly didn't see that distinction in any of their emails. I think they just thought, let's get big and then we'll fix it. And in a way, that is kind of what happened. Google came along. They got big. Google bought it. And then Google came up with all these really fantastic copyright protection programs, which now exist on YouTube, which alert the copyright owners right away. Even if, let's say, I make a video with music from Usher or something in my home video, Usher's people will be alerted to that, and then I'll get a notice saying take it down, probably.
Or
not.
Okay.
Or it's okay.
It's not offensive to
right.
us. Now, where does this fit into the proposals for the legislation that looks like it's dying, but something's going to come up, the SOPA and PIPA legislation?
Well, I think if SOPA and PIPA, I think one of the reasons that Google lobbied heavily against it is because it would have certainly made it harder, if not for YouTube, then for the next YouTube that comes along to get going, because and that's part of the safe harbor, part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is that startups are given a certain amount of leeway because they do grow into big businesses, and it does sort of help the economy generally.
And that's it was good for YouTube when Google bought it, because they had a lot more knowledge about copyright laws based on their own experiences.
Right.
How fiscally sound was YouTube when they bought it?
Well,
they spent a lot of money on it.
YouTube doesn't release its numbers apart from, they don't break them out from Google, so no one knows for sure. But the general sort of idea is that Google was losing about $1 billion a year when Google bought it, because of the amount of money it takes to store and stream all these videos, because, of course, YouTube is free. Since then, though, most analysts feel that YouTube is at least breaking even, if not actually making money now, because of all the ads that they've been able to
Though, as you say, advertisers are uncomfortable with it because it's hard to know where to place an ad.
Right, but they're getting more comfortable, and that's part of the reason for this move to professional content.
There's also the fact that, as you pointed out earlier, people don't stay on YouTube very long at any given time. So that would make it harder for an advertiser to get the message across, wouldn't it?
Right. It's kind of amazing that even though YouTube is so ubiquitous in all of our lives, we spend 5 hours a day on average watching TV, or at least some people do, and half an hour on YouTube. So there's a giant difference in just the amount of time people are watching. And that's partly because, the videos are 3 minutes long and you have an option to opt out. And you really don't know what to watch next. And it's the algorithm that tells you, not like, the coming up next, stay tuned for, like television does. So that whole mechanism of how you discover programs is something that's still very much sort of in flux and evolving on YouTube.
Our listeners have been writing in. Some have been sharing the skills that they've learned through YouTube videos. James is learning how to play the mandolin, and CJ learned how to knit. Another listener, Kurt, on Facebook says it's the world's greatest jukebox. Almost any song you come across, no matter how obscure, if you search for it on YouTube, it's usually there.
I'm totally with Kurt. And I'm also with the other guys, but I learned, I do guitar lessons on YouTube, which is a fantastic guitar teaching medium, because you see the hands, you hear the music, you see both hands. It's almost better than having a teacher come over to your house. Sorry about that, all my teachers, but it really is great.
But would it depend on whether somebody put that information up on YouTube themselves, or whether I found it and put it on YouTube?
You mean if it's a professional guitar teacher? You can kind of figure it out pretty quickly who are the good ones. Parts of it's just who's got the biggest number of hits. That's a pretty reliable indicator.
No, I just meant if I had done an instructional video, and then somebody decided to put it on YouTube, that's very different than if I decide to put something on YouTube myself to promote myself. The first
right.
one, I would think,
the first
they would be
good.
Breaking the copyright laws. No?
Well, it depends what you're playing or what you're instructing in. Or it depends on whether you gave your consent, I guess.
Yes.
But I think the main point is that, yes, YouTube is a fantastic learning mechanism. It's visual knowledge. It's a whole new category of knowledge, stuff that didn't really make sense or you didn't want to read, or people didn't even bother to write it down. They knew it, but they weren't motivated to write it down. But put a camera on them and they'll show you how to do it. It's fantastic.
When we come back from a little break, we'll talk about the YouTube Partner Program and YouTube's ways of trying to stay fresh and not be replaced by somebody else, like MySpace was replaced
right.
by Facebook. My guest is John Seabrook of The New Yorker. His article, Streaming Dreams, YouTube Turns Pro. Stay with us for more. We're back with John Seabrook of The New Yorker. His article, Streaming Dreams, YouTube Turns Pro. is about YouTube's attempts to stay fresh, to maintain its competitive edge. They must have seen what happened to other servers over the years,
right.
Servers that were big and then suddenly were replaced by somebody else. Is there anybody else out there who has come up with a similar service?
Well, online video is certainly a huge growing part of the internet. I think the bandwidth taken up by online video is something like 75% of now total bandwidth on the internet, or even more. So there certainly are a lot of other video sort of services, Vimeo being one of the larger ones. But I don't think anyone at this point is going to surpass YouTube. They're just so much bigger. They're so integrated into so many different devices.
And they have Google behind them.
And they have Google. They've done a great job of going across all platforms, iPad, iPhone, computer, and now the ultimate, the TV, which is what's coming.
That's what we're about
That's
to talk
Google
about. In
TV.
2007, the company launched the YouTube Partner Program. How does that work?
Yeah, the Partner Program is, so if you have if you're just sort of an average amateur person that puts up some YouTube videos that are popular, you can apply to the Partner Program, and YouTube will advertise against your videos and share the revenues with you 50-50 or so. And the really popular people, very young, you know, just college age or a little older, have become kind of very, you know, they're making a lot of money, up to $1 million a year on this stuff. So it's real serious money. The number of people who watch a popular YouTube video rivals the number of people who watch a popular television show, you know, 8-10 million. It's just that they don't watch it for more than 3 minutes.
So these people are doing, in effect, making their own television shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And that means that the people, viewers, will stay longer.
Yeah, and there's agents and producers, and there's a whole sort of infrastructure growing up around these people, just like we grew around television in the early days of television.
So this inspired YouTube to start thinking even about extending this further. In 2010, they recruited Robert Kinsel. Who is he?
Robert Kinsel is a guy who his unique qualification for this job is he has experience both in the entertainment world and in the information world. And as I explained in the piece, the big difference there is the information world is based on abundance. The more information out there, the better, whereas the entertainment world is based on scarcity. Value is added when you only show a program a couple of times. And from those sort of from that fundamental division come totally different mindsets. And this guy had experience in Hollywood, but he also had experience in Silicon Valley. And so his job is to try to sort of bridge those cultures for YouTube.
Didn't he also come from Netflix?
He came from Netflix, but he started out in the mailroom of a Hollywood talent agency. So he had, you know, kind of a foot in both worlds.
Didn't he launch a streaming movie rental service for YouTube?
Right.
So that's like Netflix.
What he did at Netflix, and I think Netflix is the first place where a lot of people realize, hey, this streaming stuff is actually really cool. We can sort of channel surf movies and, you know, watch as many as we want for the same price. And that was like a real revelation, I think, for a lot of people. But Netflix also had this one foot in, you know, in Adams, the world of DVD delivery. So at YouTube, it's all bits, and he's sort of taken that vision and kind of, you know, realized the fullest potential of, or at least he's trying to, at YouTube.
He's also come up with, or is he in charge of the next thing, YouTube Original Channels?
Yeah, so he's now, YouTube announced in October, my piece is quite a lot about this, that they made deals with professional television writers and directors and producers to create professional content for YouTube, and they managed to get a lot of people from, you know, for example, the guy who created CSI, Anthony Zecker, who was kind of like tired of all the rules and regulations imposed on him by network television, said, hey, you can make what you want, and you can own it. That's the two great things.
But there's a lot more money in network television.
There's a lot more money, but there's a lot of creative freedom, and when you make as much money as you can spend, and you don't have your creative freedom, that's kind of what you want.
And I'm also assuming that some people think that they can start on YouTube, and then if the thing takes off, move it to cable or to network television.
Justin Bieber started on YouTube. I mean, it's a good launching platform.
So if they put up this programming, will it be exclusive to YouTube?
It's exclusive to YouTube, but that's kind of like not really being that exclusive at all. I mean, it's kind of all over the place as soon as it's on YouTube. And in terms of, you know, scarcity, it's sort of automatically syndicated, so it's going to be there forever as many times as you want to watch it. And you can just send links around. But yes, it's for YouTube has an exclusive license to own it for a year, and then it goes back to the creator. So after that, the creators can do what they want with it.
Although it will remain on YouTube.
It will remain on YouTube.
They're starting with about 100 channels. How many do they hope to get?
Yeah, I mean, you know, 100 seems like a pretty big enough number, right? When you consider that Netflix is spending, you know, a lot of money on one original program, they're spreading it out. So a lot of music. A lot of it is kind of, you know, like early television, a lot of variety shows, which was true of the early days of television.
I imagine this is be like the early days of cable, where you had a lot of niche channels.
It's going more niche-y. So instead of just sort of a music channel, you'll have, you know, a heavy metal music channel. Instead of having just a food channel, you'll have a vegan cooking food channel. So it's just, yeah, further nichifying.
Well, that could be both positive and negative when you're trying to attract advertisers. There are just so many different places to spread yourself out to.
Right, but the idea is that the audiences for those channels are more deeply engaged and also sort of more narrowly focused demographically. So you're hitting a sweeter spot in terms of, you know, the people you hope will buy your products.
But that also suggests that people would want to watch television on their computer. Now, some do. But those big screen TVs are very popular.
But the long range idea is that this is where Google comes in. Google TV, which is launching yet another version very soon, the ultimate will be, you know, you'll turn on your television, it will be Google's menu that you see, and there'll be a bunch of apps floating around on your screen like little tropical fish in an aquarium, and one will be YouTube. And one will be NBC. And so you'll just be able to choose, and it'll all be streaming through the internet. And,
kind of like getting Netflix through the internet.
Right, which you can do on Apple TV and see it on your TV. So there'll really be no distinction between, you know, television and computer watching at some point, not too long from now, I think.
I'm talking with John Seabrook of The New Yorker about the future of YouTube. Like you said, the average person spends 15 minutes a day watching YouTube videos compared to the 4 or 5 hours a day they spend watching TV. How will YouTube eventually be able to compete with television unless people all buy into that approach that you had just...
Well, I think they're going to have to sort of, you know, introduce longer form programming. And it's not necessarily any... There's no real obstacle to it. It's just that people are used to watching stuff on their computer, often during work hours. So it's just a question of sort of, I think, shifting behavior and getting a show that's a hit, you know, people will want to see.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Brendan in the East Village writes, please ask Mr. Seabrook why the owners of YouTube put up such lousy image quality. The majority of videos are blurry and low resolution. People seem to put up with anything.
Well, the thing is that people do seem to put up with anything. I mean, this was one of Robert Kinsel's great revelations when he was at Netflix when they started streaming. Everybody said, oh, no one's going to want to stream because downloading is way better quality. But people will take convenience over quality. That's just a lesson that people have learned on the internet, and it seems to be true.
Well, couldn't they improve the quality?
They could improve the quality, and actually some of them are now sort of in HD and more. So I would assume as bandwidth increases, quality will increase. For the herky-jerky ones, it's usually because, you know, your internet connection isn't as powerful as it might be or will be.
John in Clinton Hill writes, I love the fact that it rivals the Museum of TV and Radio in that you can access almost any clip from the history of TV, including many obscure things. I mean, where else can I flash back to my childhood and watch an old commercial on a TV show, not on DVD? Also, it's full of live music performance from actual shows and bootlegs.
I totally agree with that. I use that exact same way lots of times. Go back to those old Pepsi commercials from the 60s, and it just kind of takes you back. And then seeing bands performing at their peak, particularly if you don't know those bands and you kind of are wanting to learn about them, is a great resource.
Is that any different than bootlegging a CD?
Probably not, but it's a lot easier. It's right there. It's so accessible.
A listener wants to know, does Vimeo even compare. Certainly lower viewership, but how does it measure up? There seems to be much more cultural, intelligent, artistic videos there compared to the mass media of YouTube.
That's true. Vimeo does seem to have sort of moved. I don't know how they do it, but they seem to have filtered out that the real sort of noise that sometimes you get on YouTube is just sort of random, dumb, you know, stuff that only a 10-year-old would be interested in, probably not even that. Whether they have actual, you know, the word curation is such a huge word in the internet these days, so I would assume there's some sort of curation going on there, whereas YouTube is still very much kind of open to whatever, whoever.
And people like that democratic aspect.
That's just so Google in its sort of philosophy.
Just yesterday, AOL and the Huffington Post announced that they'll be adding a live video network to their site, 12 hours of live programming a day. I guess the bigger question is, will online companies like these win the audience battle with television?
Well, anybody in the news business knows that video has become such a big part of what at The New Yorker, at The New York Times. I mean, just look at the way The New York Times has ramped up their video. So certainly video is coming as a part of information delivery. I mean, it's here. And that seems to just be growing and growing. And in a way, we're all becoming a little bit like television broadcasters, at least part-time.
And you cite in your article a study says by 2016, half of all households will have Wi-Fi-enabled devices on their television.
Which means that you'll be able to access the internet right on your TV.
And does that mean that everybody will have to participate, the cable stations, everybody?
Well, I think it puts pressure on the cable stations because now you don't need your cable.
Right.
Bill.
You don't have to pay for cable.
You can cut your cable bill.
And maybe you'll be able to watch Knick games in New York.
You know what? I bet you will. And you'll probably be able to watch all kinds of sports things that your cable company won't let you watch. So they're both a great potential for freedom and a potential for real pressure being put on the cable companies because nobody I know is happy with their... You know, you pay all this money for cable and you only watch a couple of the shows. Why not just get the shows you watch, you know, and do away with the rest?
Well, should we be surprised to see what's happening? Isn't this what's happened historically with any new medium or new content provider like the cable channels? Something new comes along and steals the old system's audience.
That's the way it's gone so far. Channel expansion and audience fragmentation is definitely the history of the evolution of television. And it seems like it's going to continue to evolve. And we're at the third turn of the wheel with YouTube.
On the other hand, the advertisers spend $60 billion on TV and $3 billion on online video. So there's still a long way
you can
for
look
places
at that
like
two
YouTube
ways.
To go.
So you can look at that, wow, there's a huge potential here for growth. Or you can look at it, yeah, this is really not serious yet. But I think, you know, the smart people are looking at it as, wow, there's a whole lot of potential here because... Anybody with kids knows that they don't care whether it's – in fact, my kid never watches TV at all. They watch YouTube. And you project that 20 years down the road, that doesn't look good for traditional broadcast and cable television.
Well, I'd imagine any college kid with a computer is not bringing a television set to the dorm room anymore.
That's a good point. It'd be interesting to know. Probably not.
John,
they're playing video games on it if they have one there.
When they should be doing their homework. But that's a whole other matter. Thank you so much for being with us, John. John Seabrook's article, Streaming Dreams, YouTube Turns Pro, is in The New Yorker. And we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. It's always a pleasure having you here.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here again.